ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ. ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ. ఓం నమో భగవతే వాసుదేవాయ. ఓం అగ్నాథనంతస్య అగ్నాగనాశలకయ చక్షుమిలితం జిన తస్మై శ్రీగరే నమః. శ్రీచైతన్యమనోభీష్టం స్థాపితం యేన భూతలే స్వయం రూపాకృతమయం దదతి స్వాపదాంతికం. వందేహం శ్రీగరు శ్రీయుతపతికమలం శ్రీగరుం వైష్ణవంశ్చ శ్రీరూపం సుగర్జితం సహగణారఘునాథం వితం తాం సజీవం సాద్వైతం సవదుతం ప్రవచన సహితం కృష్ణచైతన్యదేవం శ్రీరాధాకృష్ణపదం సహగణలలిత శ్రీ విశాఖకృతం హే కృష్ణ కరుణ సింధు దీనబంధో జగత్పతే గోపిషా గోపికా కాంత రాధకాంత నమోస్తుతే తప్త కంచన గౌరంజీ రాధా వృందావనేశ్వరీ విశాఖనుసతి దేవి ప్రమణి హరి ప్రియ వాంచకపత బ్రూష్ట కృపసింధువే పతితనం భవనేవ్యో వైష్ణవ్యో నమో నమః. శ్రీకృష్ణ చైతన్య ప్రభు నిత్యానంద శ్రీ అద్వైత గదాధర శ్రీవాసరి గౌర భక్తవృంద హరే కృష్ణ 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 హరే 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 రామ 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 హరే హరే. We're reading from the fifth canto. We're still reading from the fifth canto. I've been kind of ill the last 10 days or so with a flu, so I kind of missed out on some of the subtle and more vivid points of philosophy here in the fifth canto. Let's see where we are today. We're at the descendants of King Priyavrata, chapter 15, canto 5, text 14 to 15, which are not in meter, so I'll just read the Sanskrit and then the English translation. Is that okay? Gayat, from Maharaj Gaya, Gayatyam, in his wife named Gayanti, Chitradataha, named Chitrata, Sugatihi, named Sugati, Avrodhanaha, named Avarodhana. Iti, thus, Traya, three, Putra, sons, Babuvuhu, were born. Chicharatat, from Chicharat, Unayam, in the womb of Urna, Samrat, named Samrat, Ajanista was born, Tata from him, Utkalayam, in his wife named Utkala, Marichi named Marichi, Maricha from Marichi, Bindumatyam, in the womb of his wife Bindumati. Bindum, a son named Bindu. Anudapadyata was born. Tasmat, from him. Saragyayam, in the womb of his wife Saragya. Madhu, Madhu, Nama, named Abavat, was born Madhu from Madhu. Sumanasi, in the womb of his wife Sumana. Viravrata, a son named Viravrata. Tataha, from Viravrata. Boyayam, in the womb of his wife Boja. Mantu Pramantu, two sons named Mantu and Pramantu. Jagyate, were born Mantaha from Mantu, Satyayam, in his wife Satya. Bhovanaha, a son named Bhovana. Tataha, from him. What do you think's next? In the womb of his wife, Dushnayam. In the womb of his wife, Dushana. Tvasta, one son named Tvasta, okay. Agyanista, was born Tvastuhu, from Tvasta. Virochanayam, and his wife named Virochana. Virajaha, a son named Viraj. Virajasya, of King Viraja. Satyajit Pravaram, headed by Satyajit. Putrashatam, 100 sons. Kanya, a daughter. Lucky her. Cha, also. Vishnucham, in his wife Visuchi. Kila, indeed. Jatam, took birth. Okay, now without looking, who is the wife of Marichi? Quickly. Nobody figured it out. Okay. Very hard to remember the lineages. Translation. We'll give you a second chance now. In the womb of a Gayatri, Maharaj, I feel like singing this. In the womb of Gayatri, Maharaj Gaya begot three sons named Chitarata, Sugati, and Avrodan. And in the womb of his wife, Urna, Chitarata begot a son named Samrat. And the wife of Samrat was Utkala. And in her womb, Samrat begot a son named Marichi. And in the womb of his wife, Bindumati, Marichi begot a son named Bindu. And in the womb of his wife, Saraga, this is not for brahmacharis, by the way, Bindu begot a son named Madhu. And in the womb of his wife, named Sumana, Madhu begot a son named Vivarat. And in the womb of his wife, Boja, Vivarat begot two sons named Matu and Pramatu. And in the womb of his wife, Satya, Matu begot a son named Bhovana. And in the womb of his wife, Dushana, Bhovana begot a son named Tvashta. And in the womb of his wife, Virochana, it's enough with the wombs, Tvashta begot a son named Viraja. And the wife of Viraj was Visuchi. And in her womb, Viraja begot 100 sons and one daughter. One daughter, at least one daughter. That daughter goes unnamed, unfortunately. And of all these sons, the son named Satyajit was predominant. And and thus the universe is populated. Why is this important? And I think Srila Prabhupada must have felt the same way, because there is absolutely no purport. But it must be important because it's in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Why is it important? We're going to discuss that question today. But I just have a quick question. Are we reading text 16? Is that on there also or not? Huh? No? Simply 14 to 15. So we just have a verse and no purport. Purport by His Grace, Nisringananda Prabhu. Om Agyanatam Anandasyakanagana Shalakaya Shakshuant Militam Nyanatas My Shigarev Namaha. I offer my humble obeisances to the lotus feet of my spiritual master, who has opened my eyes, blinded by the torchlight, blinded by the darkness of ignorance with the torchlight of knowledge. Well, the question before this August assembly is, why do we need to know all this information? Why did Prakrit Maharaj, in his last week in that body, be informed about the descendants by name coming from Maharaj Priyavrat? I asked this question to a number of senior devotees this morning because I did not have the answer to this question. One of them said, well, they're all important kings, so we should be very... we should be taking the association of these important kings through their names, since they had direct relationship with Krishna. That was one answer. Anything in relationship with Krishna, of course, is our business. Any devotee who has a relationship with Krishna, then we also want to take association of that devotee. My reply to that was, we're all descendants. We're all coming as progeny from Manu. So, in that sense, we're all important. No. The reply was that these are really important kings. And I said, well, they're not all kings, as far as I can see. I mean, they might be. But it doesn't say that they're all Maharajas. In fact, the last womb begot of Viraja, there was 100 sons out of that womb. And only one of them is considered predominant. Son named Satyajit. So I looked up Satyajit. Sat and Jit. Jit means in Sanskrit some victory. And Sat has a number of different meanings. One of them is it means eternal or lasting. Another meaning of it is dull, very dull headed. So this son was somehow predominant, and his name suggests that he was victorious over any kind of dullness that existed in the world, or anything mundane. He was he was fighting to some degree this lack of spirituality, mundaneness. Speculation completely, because there's no purport. And the question remains, why is it important for us to understand, or hear, just to hear? Why was it important for Shukadev to answer the question? Why didn't he say to Maharaj Parikshit, you know, these dynasties have many names of great personalities. That's all you need to know. When we read these various descriptions, for most of us, not all, because some of us are very retentive in memory, for most of us it's in one ear and out the other, isn't it? Oh, yeah, okay. What else is new? Why do I care? I don't know the persons. I have no relationship to them. I offered the argument to one devotee this morning that when we first were given the Bhagavad Gita, there was a short list of the parampara. You know, it went millions of years, you know, Brahma, Narada, you know, all of a sudden you were, you know, eight, nine names later, you were Bhaktivinoda. As great acharyas in our line of our disciplic succession. It was, we accepted Srila Prabhupada's position with such faith that nobody in the first few years even asked the question, was there anybody in between in the disciplic succession, or did they just live that long and pass it on to the next acharya? I think even today, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita as it is, you see a very short list of, I'm not sure where it is, but anyway, a very short list of the acharyas. Now, of course, we filled in many of the blanks. Devotees got curious. Hare Krishna. But still, it's 5,000 years. Hardly our list is complete. So, is it really important? What's more important? The faith, the shraddha, in the words of your spiritual authority that you've accepted in your heart, or do we get faith by listening to this kind of historical progression? Does that engender our faith? Or for those of us that already have faith, does it really matter? And those that don't have faith, is it helpful? These are all questions I started to ask myself when I read this verse and said, what am I going to talk about? Prabhupada doesn't give me any purport from which I can start. You know, then you start looking for clues. And then you start thinking about the larger issue. So I asked another devotee. These are all very erudite devotees. And he said, well, the historical principle is very important. We have to establish that this is not fiction. This is not mythology. Therefore, Shukadev is giving this information so that generations can accept and understand that this is actually a very scientific history. It's a history lesson. It shows that there is continuity. There's, you know, just like in the Bible. There's, you know, from Abraham comes Isaac, from Isaac comes Jacob. There's a similar type of biography of the various progenitors from the beginning of the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve. So somebody recognized in that tradition that there should be a history. And without history, there's no faith. You know, people have blind faith in the Bible. They're called, in a vernacular, called Bible thumpers. Why are they Bible thumpers? Because they take the Bible, and when they're preaching at the pulpit, they bang it on the pulpit. They're called Bible thumpers. This is the good book. You've got to believe. And when you believe in the Bible and Jesus, like that. So they're Bible thumpers. We don't treat our books like that. But there's the idea that people generally require history. And if you see in your own family some of your Gotrams, you look to your lineage for clues and hints about your duties to some degree, even though it's a shadow of former ages when Gotrams meant a lot more. Still, especially in the South, you look at your caste for a certain amount of identity with your body and what its dharma is, its duty. People live in that paradigm. Of course, when you become a devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, everything changes. Why is that? Because he didn't base any of the qualifications on birth. He was a social revolutionary. The idea of somehow your janma determining your duty was no longer relevant because everybody was disqualified in the age of Kali, no matter how great your parentage and your ancestry. And he emphasized this principle of dvija bandhu, second birth. When you have accepted the instructions of the spiritual master in your heart, which is the real dvija bandhu, by the way. You can get diksha from so many gurus, but only when you accept those instructions in your heart is the real initiation take place. And that dvija, that changes, that allowed, that concept allowed saintly personalities to extend spiritual realization, Krishna consciousness, to persons like myself and others who are immensely disqualified from birth and family. My mother told my sisters and myself one time proudly, she proudly said, "You know, we're descendants from the House of Habsburg." That's the Hungarian royalty. And she said, we asked her, "How?" You know, she says, "Oh yes, you're a royal family. We're a royal family." She said that the mistress of Franz Joseph. In other words, he had sex with it wasn't his wife. And we're descendants from that royal. That's her claim to our royal blood, you know, through illicit relationships. That's how fallen we become, disqualified in the age of Kali, you know, that we can claim that we're somehow elevated through illicit relationships. Oh my gosh. But for most people, even today, birth is very important. I know because we've taken to Krishna consciousness, we've eschewed that paradigm to a great degree. More for some, less for others. But in the final analysis, we all agree, at least intellectually, that birth is irrelevant. Although it does affect how we act, of course, because we have certain samskaras we carry with us. But it doesn't disqualify us from advancing in Krishna consciousness, which is transcendent. But most people really are into their families. It's called, as Prabhupada said in the early days, this is our skin disease. This family attachment. My favorite phrase, one of my favorite phrases from Srila Prabhupada, was so revolutionary that you couldn't even say it to your family, because they would think that you were somehow brainwashed. And that phrase is that friendship, society, and love is what those things keep us bound to the material world. Friendship, society, and love. Try telling your mother that. Hi, Mom. Friendship, society, and love, these are my enemies. You know, it's impossible, because it's actually such a profound statement. It goes so deep. And it is 100% true. You'll know that even if you don't realize it now. At the time of death, the realization becomes crystal clear. Ask anyone who's been close to death, or even experienced a death of a departed loved one. That sense of understanding of friendship, society, and love being what hold us and bind us, like these ropes to the material world, becomes crystal clear. Anyone who's even gone through a divorce and seen their entire fortunes disappear, their family turn against them, their wife or their husband become, in effect, another person and become their enemy, realizes in a flash, why did I sacrifice so much? For what reason did I give so much importance to these temporary enjoyments? Now, in the beginning, when Prabhupada spoke like that and we got it very clearly, I thought, that's it. I won't have any more friends. I won't be a part of any society anymore. And I certainly won't get married. That I was 100% sure I was not going to get married. Friendship, society, and love. It's 40 years later. I'm married. I got kids. I have so many friends. I have a great society, friends, and devotees. And I live in a grander society. As Sridhar Swami was fond of saying, before you become Krishna conscious, first you become conscious. So we have to become also conscious of our position. That, you know, we are in this world, but we're not of this world. And most people believe that this world is the elixir of all existence. When the scientists talk of life of other planet on other planets, they think of this civilization, of this thing called mankind, as this unique species, somehow practically only inhabiting this little one planet amidst a infinite variety of barren spheres and orbs, and they're desperately searching for some other life way out there with their radio telescopes. They're looking for more society, more family, more love. That's the goal of almost every living being, to expand their brood, to their sense of belonging, their identity with other human bodies. So family is so important that it becomes, in a sense, a very real part of the Bhagavatam, this idea that there is progeny from one womb injected into another, and on. And so when we think about why it's important for us to hear this progression of hierarchy, we can understand that it's maybe not for us. Maybe it's not directed. Maybe Shukadeva is not just speaking this at the request of Parikshit Maharaj for the benefit of Parikshit Maharaj. There's something greater happening here. Shukadeva is not speaking to just one king. Srimad Bhagavatam is not just for him. It's a gift that's being resonated for thousands and thousands of years to help all living beings progress on that road back home, back to Godhead. And in that sense, it's much easier to understand why we're hearing all these names. Because we already have faith in our guru and we have faith in the process, but many people do not. And they're very attached to the material concept of life. And for them, progeny and gotram, it's all very important. And they need to identify with it at first. They need to have an anchor by which they can then rotate around association of saintly people and devotees in the philosophy. I know my mother is very much attached to the whole progression of our family. She once drew a family tree. It was very bewildering to me. This many cousins and that many second cousins and third cousins, and now in today's families it becomes exponentially more complicated because you have what's called extended families. Where there's, okay, the first marriage, these are the sisters and brothers, and then there's the half-brothers and the half-sisters, and their cousins are half-cousins to those cousins, and then they become a quarter-cousin to that cousin, and that's your grandmother on that side, but on this side it's your stepmother's father's sister's aunt. People are into it. The Mormons have made a whole religion around it. Ancestry. It's very important because you see what their idea is, that when they become free from the shackles of this mortal frame, they're going to meet that grandmother that died and that father that passed away suddenly from a cardiac arrest and that brother who was killed in the war. They're all going to meet in this big lobby in the sky, this hotel lobby somewhere in the sky. I was sitting on a plane from Utah to L.A. Happened to sit next to a young Mormon who's spending his 2 years preaching. They have a principle that when you finish your high school, before you start college, you have to go out and preach door to door. Dressed very nicely. And so he was sitting next to me in the plane, and I turned to him. I said, you know, I've always been wondering about this aspect of your philosophy where you're going to meet your beloveds in some heavenly realm. I said, is it true? You're going to see grandma? If she died, you're going to see it? Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's going to be there. The whole family will eventually be resurrected in their heavenly, you know, heavenly. I said, well, how are you going to recognize her? What do you mean? How am I going to recognize her? I said, well, you know, she might have died when she was 90. And then when she is resurrected to that, she might, you know, obviously she doesn't want to have an old body. She's going to maybe be this like really hot 19-year-old, you know, that's, you know, really sexy. So how are you going to, you know, she's your grandmother and, yet, you know, you might see her and you might, you know, want her. I mean, how does that work? Because certainly, you know, you don't want to go to heaven and live in these, you know, these old bodies with all the problems of old age. So he said to me, well, I don't know. You have to ask one of our elders. I don't know the answer to that. People are so attached to the bodily conception that even they want to join their families in the next world. So here, I think this is, to a certain degree, a it's a word. It's a means by which people who are not so advanced can understand that through family and through descendants, we have all come. And some of them are very great. Especially, you know, there's 100 sons and only one stands out. So.
Hi. Hi there. Hi. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Then I asked another devotee this morning about it. And he was supposed to do some research. I'm going to do some research. Did he do that research?
This is the way what?
Right. There's on the top of that, the Godhead once. It says, Godhead is light, and essence is darkness. Where there is light, there is no darkness. There is God. What is it? Light, there is no darkness?
Yes.
Darkness. So, the pursuance of niscience, or the knowledge of the material atmosphere, the material world, is a part of our strength that we get to pursue our spiritual activities. Along with this knowledge of Krishna, the gopis, and Lord Jagannath's pastimes, and so many different stories of the deities, and the great kings, and all of the things that happen in spiritual life, we also have to cultivate along with that the nescience, the knowledge of the material world, so that we're running on both tracks. We're not imbalanced in such a way that we can't even hardly exist or feed ourselves or understand what's going on around us. Krishna gives a whole long, I would say not a chapter, because Krishna didn't write Bhagavad Gita, but he speaks quite in length about the divine and the demonic natures, the suras and the asuras. Everything is there so that we have this knowledge of both material knowledge and spiritual knowledge, because without both we can't really extend ourselves very very much in spiritual life and be able to stand strongly. Now I'm going to read one thing that I came across that I thought was really interesting. Descendants of Priyavrata, the eldest son of Swayambhuvamanu, his 10 sons, 3 adopt a religious life. The others become kings of the 7 isles of the earth. This is in the very, very beginning, before we have reached these descendants here. And Agnidra is the king of Jambudvip. That's divided into 9 portions, which he distributes among his sons. Nabi, king of the south, succeeded by Rishab and by Bharat. And India is named after him. So there's a whole history that goes way back. And when you start studying it, Agni, the king of Jambudvip, had 9 sons. And they were equal in splendor to the patriarchs. They were named Nabi, Kimparush, Harivarsh, Ilavrit, Ram, Ya, Hiranvat, Kuru, Bhadrashya, and Ketumal, who was a prince ever active in the practice of piety. And then there's a story of Maitreya and the 8 varshas, or counties, that Kumbharush and the rest, which are places of perfect enjoyment where happiness is spontaneous and uninterrupted. These are descriptions of various parts of the worlds. And then we have the term, the place of Bharat, and him consigning his kingdom to Sumati, who is a most virtuous prince, and engaging in devout practices. And then from Sumati was born Indradumna, and his son was Paramishitam, and his son was Pritahara, who had a celebrated son, Baba. And on it goes. And so this creation by which the earth was peopled and where he was presiding gives a sense to people who understand the family that we are all descendants and we are all, in a sense, related. But there are some great personalities who have come to enliven and to enlighten us. And those are the personalities that stand out. That's why that list that Prabhupada gave us of the acharyas in the first edition of the Bhagavad Gita, he didn't need to name all of them. Just the ones that would have the greatest impact for us in terms of our being able to study and associate with them. And similarly, it's important for people to know that we have this lineage, but at the same time, we don't dwell on the lesser personalities, not lesser, but the less, the ones that impacted history less than others. It's just like Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says of all the bodies of water on the ocean, of all the stars on the sun, of all the aquatics on the shark. He doesn't say, I'm the shark, but I'm also the the porpoise, I'm also the tuna, I'm also the goldfish, he doesn't have to say all that. He's just giving the greatest. We just have to think of the greatest. That's it. So similarly, in this way, we should understand why we are learning about these various descendants. It's interesting, one devotee told me this morning that Bhakti Siddhanta, Sarasvati Maharaj, had created an exam for an acharya. It's an acharya exam. And one of the questions in that exam asked who was the descendant of whom. In other words, he expected that a person who was on that level of being an acharya should be able to recite from memory all the different descendants that we read here. And in a conversation that Srila Prabhupada had with the famous poet Allen Ginsberg, it's an amazing recitation. Because Allen Ginsberg is asking questions in Columbus, Ohio in 1967. He's asking Srila Prabhupada just about what we're studying, how this whole universe got populated. And from memory, Prabhupada was giving names of descendants. That's an acharya. Prabhupada's scope, his breath, his memory for all these things was just perfect. He was, in fact, we talk about the book Bhagavatam and the person Bhagavatam. So faith in the mind of this poet, Allen Ginsberg, who helped our movement immeasurably in the beginning, gain traction in America. Prabhupada was very grateful to him. In fact, Allen Ginsberg himself had a very good memory for these things. Allen Ginsberg had been to Vrindavan. Allen Ginsberg had been to Varanasi and he'd been to Rishikesh. When Prabhupada asked him, have you been here? But yes, I saw this temple, I saw that deity. No, I didn't see this one. Vamsa Bihari, no, I didn't see it. And so Prabhupada was very enlivened speaking to him because he was a man of, you know, tremendous intellectual wisdom. But Prabhupada knew these relationships and these various ancestries. Now, it's not easy for anyone to memorize all of the different names of all the different dynasties. But it's important for us to recognize a great saintly person such as Prabhupada had that ability. So this is how we recognize people who are very elevated in their Krishna consciousness, that their ability to recite Bhagavatam in a moment, just in a snap of the fingers, was so precise that they are, in fact, the Bhagavatam, the person Bhagavatam. That's Srila Prabhupada. And I think in many ways, we have very great personalities in our movement. And I think each one of them would agree that none of us can hold a match. We can't even hold a match to what is that brilliant sun that Srila Prabhupada is emanating with his knowledge and wisdom. And it's why we study Prabhupada's book so carefully. Because in his purports, he's able to reach into all the nooks and crannies of Vaishnava history and culture and just pick out those things necessary for us to increase our faith, increase our Shraddha. That's the point. So even though we don't gain much philosophy from reading these genealogies, we can gain faith that there is a real history, there is a real ancestry, not just to the parampara that we're in, but actually to the whole history of the world. And this is flying just under the radar of all the anthropologists and the religionists, people who are studying how this earth came into being, how it came to be populated. It's just under the radar because they are lacking a little faith. And perhaps, just like when Dwarka got proven as a real city that was now buried in the sea off of the existing Dwarka, or when the satellites traced the actual Saraswati, that so-called mythical river, or when it saw the outline of some bridge underwater to Lanka, to Sri Lanka. As time progresses, these various histories will become more accepted and more proved because they're becoming proven. And we don't know what the future will bring, but much of what's in the Bhagavatam may come to light in a more tactile way as discoveries are made. But for certain, it gives people faith that there is a family of mankind that has brought forth from this original Krishna conscious culture, the present day Kali Yuga, and within that, the revival of the acknowledgement of this very illustrious lineage for everyone. And for all of those reasons, I think it's useful and important to appreciate that Shukadev is reciting this to Maharaj Parikshit, not just for his benefit, but for the benefit of all generations to come. And in that way, we read this with great awe and respect. And somehow or another, it even unseen, it increases our understanding and commitment. That's why I wanted to read text 16, but you'll have to wait till tomorrow. So maybe there's some comments or questions about what I've said or about the verse? Ananta Prabhu.
Prabhuji, after you ask me that... in the morning, after the Tulasi...
A little louder, can you speak louder?
I went to read the books, and in Canto 3, and Canto 4, and Daksha over there, there are also many lineages mentioned in slokas. And after one of those slokas, there's a long list of these born, his son was so and so born. After the lineage list, the subsequent sloka in the translation itself, it says that it is... it's very purifying and away from our sin, does away with sinful reactions by reading these lineages, lists and lines, dynasties, this histories. It is purifying and removes sinful reactions. That's mentioned in the sloka subsequent to the listed lineage line sloka. So that is also one point.
Did it say why it's purifying?
No, that
That
you have explained as connected to Krishna.
Yeah, I mean that's a stock answer. Because it's connected to Krishna, it's purifying. But everything, you know, from my point of view, what's not connected to Krishna is only in our minds. That's Maya. Everything's connected to Krishna. The pure devotee doesn't see anything separated from Krishna. So again, it's for the benefit of people if they are understanding that it's connected to Krishna, that they're being purified in that sense. Of course, the whole Bhagavatam, reading the Bhagavatam, is you're connecting with Krishna. So I think that's axiomatic. And I'm still, you know, I still wanted to explore why it's purifying. Because people ask us these questions. They want to know, why are you reading all those names? Why is that important? These are questions that very smart, inquisitive people have when you're preaching and when you say, I don't know. You have to ask my superior, and most of us don't know. We're guessing. But I think I've offered a few ideas for how to respond and why it is important, along with the scriptural injunction of this idea that gotra is, in this day and age, ultimately not an important issue. At least I'm praying it's not, because I don't have a very good one. Are there any more questions or comments? Yes, Mukesh. Yes, Mukesh.
It is said that if we want to please Krishna, we have to please the spiritual master. Right?
Yes.
Then in your case, Prabhupada is your spiritual master. But for the second generation of devotees, he may be another acharya of our movement. So he should satisfy the particular instruction of that acharya that will please Krishna? Is it so like that?
Guru is one. I mean, when we talk about satisfying the Guru, we accept the fact that Krishna is the original Guru. And then we also understand from Chaitanya Charitamrita that Nityananda Prabhu represents that same person, that same guru. And Prabhupada is representing that, not representing, but he is acting as that guru, that is Krishna, because he's a transparent medium. To the degree that your guru is that transparent medium, things are satisfying Krishna. If you have a bogus guru, it's not transparent. So, if you have a guru who is fully representing Krishna and the acharyas, then you're satisfying Prabhupada, because he's transparent. Just make sure you have a guru that's doing that. That's your job. You have to make sure that your guru is fully representative. And if he's not fully representative, in your estimation, then your main inspiration may come from a shiksha relationship with Prabhupada. Because ultimately there's no difference between the shiksha and the diksha.
There is no?
No real difference between shiksha and diksha relationships. So, it just depends on the individual. This is a very gated movement. There's a variety for everybody. You can't take a cookie cutter and stamp everybody same. Some people will respond favorably to one person. One person may respond favorably to another and not favorably to that one. We have to really acknowledge and celebrate our differences.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Prabhuji, you said some elements. He's a great poet of, you know, she helped Prabhupada. What is that?
Allen Ginsberg.
So how we know George Harrison? He helped Prabhupada in the movement. So can you just little bit tell how he helped Prabhupada in this to propagate Krishna consciousness?
Gosh, a little bit about George.
I know about George, but I'm telling about that person who told na he helped Lord Prabhupada. Allen Bins.
Oh, Allen Ginsberg?
So can you just tell me how he helped you, Prabhupada?
Allen Ginsberg gave his name, fame, and reputation to Prabhupada, but most importantly, Prabhupada was very happy that Allen Ginsberg chanted Hare Krishna and encouraged other people to do so. Were it not for Allen Ginsberg, we wouldn't have been able to put together in San Francisco there was a concert that was organized by Mukunda and Maharaj and others at that time that pulled together some of the most well-known rock groups of the time and therefore attracted a lot of people. It was a turning point for our movement. And Allen Ginsberg lent his name and his good offices to that. Were it not for him, the groups wouldn't have necessarily come in. He was also very helpful in getting Prabhupada's visa extended. I mean, he did so many things that he wrote introductions to Prabhupada's books. He was very much present, although later on he went his own way. He was very much present in the beginning years to aid Prabhupada in very practical matters, as well as give his... He was very famous, so... You know, and he liked Prabhupada a lot. He was very respectful. And he felt that in his circles where he went, he loved chanting Hare Krishna. He just had a natural attraction. So it legitimized the Hare Krishna movement in those times, his name connected with our movement. He was a published author. And people, when they saw that Allen Ginsberg was chanting Hare Krishna, they were only happy to join in. But to answer you more specifically, it's interesting that you mention that. I'll read you one thing, very interesting, that I was reading this morning. Prabhupada said, this is a conversation with Allen Ginsberg. Prabhupada says, 6 or 7 years old, my father was worshipping, so I wanted to imitate, and I asked him, give me deity. So he gave me, Allen. Did you wash them and play with them? Prabhupada, yes, washed, changed dress. Allen, fed them? Prabhupada, yes, everything. Allen, do you still wash them and feed them and play with them? He was thinking like they're dolls, you know. Prabhupada, yes. Oh, now my disciples I have, he laughs. Oh, at home I was doing that. Allen, well, what are you reading? Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam. This is original Sanskrit. There are 8 commentaries by big stalwart scholars. Alan, these are the commentaries and this is the text? Prabhupada, this is the text. What does the Sanskrit sound like? Is Srimad Bhagavatam to be chanted? Prabhupada, well, yes, I'll read you some portion. So he reads something. Alan, ooh, it's beautiful, beautiful. Prabhupada, oh yes. Oh, the Sanskrit poetry writing is very difficult. They've got rhetoric systems. So many words should be first, so many words second. You cannot deviate. Alan, yes. And then, Prabhupada, then the analogy and the metaphor should be like that. Nothing should be twice repeated. So there's this Sahitra Ratna in Sanskrit. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu defeated one great scholar simply by a little mistake. Yes, Keshava Kashmiri. Keshava Kashmiri was a great scholar, and Sanskrit great scholar means he must fluently speak in Sanskrit verses everything. Alan, everything he says must be done in perfect Sanskrit verse? Oh, Prabhupada, yes, that is Sanskrit scholar, not in prose. He'll go on composing verses. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu at that time, he was 16 years old boy, and he was very learned logician. So Keshava Kashmiri, he was traveling all over India, competing with other pundits, other learned scholars. And so everywhere he was victorious. And so he came to Navadvip. And in those days, Navadvip and Benares and Udipi and Kashmir, 4 or 5 places, they were very scholarly. Alan. Well, I've been to Birbhum, Prabhupada, Birbhum. Yeah, I've been through Birbhum and Navadvip also. And Prabhupada continues. So, when he came to Navadvip, in all the other places he was victorious. So the Navadvip pandits, they conferred that Nimai Pandit should be put forward to talk with him. And if he's defeated by Nimai Pandit, then we'll become victorious because a boy has defeated him. But if Nimai Pandit becomes defeated, then we'll get another chance. In this way, so Keshava Kashmiri was informed, first of all, they'll have to talk with Nimai Pandit. So one day, Nimai Pandit, he was talking with his students, and Keshava was strolling on the Ganges side. So he heard that this boy is Nimai Pandit. Oh, I'll have to talk with him. He's a boy. So he went there, and when he was acquainted with Keshava Kashmiri, oh, please, come sit. So Nimai Pandit said that I heard you are also such a learned scholar. Now we're on the Ganges side. You can chant the glorification of Mother Ganges. She may hear and enjoy. So he was a very learned scholar. And out of that 100 verses, in the 64th verse, there were some poetic discrepancies. Now remember, Allen Ginsberg is a poet. So Prabhupada has picked out of all the things that he could pick from, this one example for Allen. Just cast perfectly for him. Right? So then the word was Bhavana, Bhavani Bharat. Bhavani means the wife of Bhav. Lord Shiva is called Bhav. And Lord Brahma is called Aja, and Lord Shiva is called Bhav. So Bhav means from whom everything is born. Lord Shiva is the father of this Bhav. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that in the 64th verse, you stated Bhavani Bharat. And Bhavani means the husband of, and Bhavani means the wife of Bhav, Lord Shiva. So it's known that she has a husband. Then why you say Bharata again, husband? He was a learned scholar. And he could understand, yes, dvir ukti dosh. This is called dvir ukti dosh. Repeating twice one thing. Dvir ukti dosh. That is dosh. Dosh means fault. Just imagine, here is this scholar, Prabhupada, picking out this one verse, not only this one pastime. Not only does he pick out this one pastime, but he knows this phrase, dir dvir ukti dosh. That's how deep his knowledge goes. You know, when you study Prabhupada like this, you begin to wonder, how does he remember? How did he know all that? How does he remember everything? And pick it out of thin air is the perfect thing to say to this guy. So, Allen Ginsberg, the Prabhupada's dosh, in Sanskrit word it's called, so then Allen Ginsberg says, yeah, fault, yes. Anyway, Prabhupada goes on. And so Allen Ginsberg says, well, did Chaitanya worship Sarasvati? I'll read this thing ahead of it. It's interesting for brahmacharis. Prabhupada says, the grace of Mother Saraswati, just like you can compose 100 verses within a few minutes, I can, whatever you say, I can remember immediately. Formerly, that was the system of understanding the Vedas, shruti, simply by hearing. Once they hear from the spiritual master, they will remember. The memory was so sharp. Therefore, this brahmachari system is so nice. They can enhance their memorizing power. Brahmachari. Alan, did Lord Chaitanya worship Saraswati? Prabhupada, no, he was a Vaishnav. But every demigod is worshipped. It's not that one should neglect. Ginsberg, oh, respect, he respected. Prabhupada, yes. Alan, I know one mantra in Bengali to Saraswati. Jaya Jaya, David Jaya Jaya Sari, Kuchuku Vishori Mukti Vihari, Vira Nadita Palake Vihati Bhagavati. Prabhupada, oh yes. Saraswati Stotra. Yes, students are supposed to offer stotras. Students specifically. So that's a mantra for students, for Saraswati? Prabhupada, yes. Vidya, the goddess of learning. Saraswati. In our childhood, we used to worship Saraswati. Please, Mother, give me a pass on this examination. That was our prayer. So other students, they laughed very loudly. They thought that Chaitanya has come out very victorious within a second. And he said, no, stop. And then he stopped all these talkings. He said, so you, I have to talk with you. You're very learned. Ordinary formalities. And then he went away. And he was also a great worshipper of Mother Saraswati. And he began to pray to Mother Saraswati. Mother Saraswati, by your grace, I've become victorious in so many places. This is the Keshviri speaking to Mother Saraswati, because he worshipped the goddess of learning. And what is this that I am defeated by a boy who is a grammar student? So he began to pray, and Mother Saraswati informed him, he is God, my husband. So you speak means I speak. So how can I defeat my husband? This is the logic that Keshwari is hearing from Saraswati, that she can't give him the words to defeat Chaitanya Mahaprabhu because that's her husband. The perfect, you know, such perfect logic, right? So, come on. You can... So then he further did not attempt to talk with him, and he went away. And the Mother Saraswati advised him that you surrender unto him. That will be your nice role. Yes, and so later on, Keshava Keshmiri became a great devotee of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So anyway, it goes on and on and on with Prabhupada talking to Allen Ginsberg. And at the end, Ginsberg says, Ginsberg says that he chanted, when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, Ginsberg says, I also chanted Hare Krishna for Robert Kennedy before he died. So he's taken this idea from Prabhupada of chanting Hare Krishna, and he's now even given it to the biggest politicians in the country. Now this is some of the pastimes, you know, of Allen Ginsberg that are not so well known. He did a lot to help us, our movement, and we are forever grateful. Thank you all for listening to me. I apologize. I've been not so well the last 10 days with the flu. And so I'm kind of coming back. I hope to be dancing again with you soon. It's a great privilege always to be dancing in kirtan with the devotees of this temple particularly. All glories to His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki.